This is In the Hive, a show that looks at the issues and ideas that tie the Greater Salt Lake Valley together. I'm Emily Means, and today on the show we talk about the recently excavated Tyrannosaur fossil found at Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument. The fossil was airlifted to the Natural History Museum of Utah in October after being discovered 2 years ago by Alan Titus, a paleontologist at the monument. At the museum's annual Behind the Scenes event, where the staff opens the collections to the public, the Tyrannosaur was a major draw for visitors, and museum employees were just as excited about it.
I'm Tyler Berthesel. I'm the paleontology lab and field manager here at the Natural History Museum of Utah.
Tyler, this T-Rex fossil that you guys have recently received is huge, right? One of the most complete T-Rex fossils that we've seen here in this region of the U.S. So when you receive a fossil this large, what is your first thought? And are there any kinds of special considerations that come to mind when you're housing and caring for something like this?
Typically, my first thought when we bring everything back to the museum is, where are we going to put it? For this one, since it's a Tyrannosaur and it was so complete when we were finding it out in the field, my first thing is, okay, we need to start working on it into the lab. So it shoots up right at the top of the list of specimens we want to prepare. So that's exactly what happened when it came in here. I immediately took the skull block into the lab and a few of the other blocks to get volunteers starting to work all the preparation on the specimens.
So what are you doing with it? You're just kind of like cleaning it up, or do you apply some sort of, I don't know, chemical to it or something? What does the process look like?
Yep. So the first thing that we do is we cut open the plaster cast that protected the fossil to get it back to the museum. And then after we've done that, in the field, we only remove enough rock to get the size and shape of the bones that we have. Because if we start removing too much rock in the field, it's really easy to damage or lose pieces of them. So once we crack open the specimens here, then is the long, arduous journey of using small tools called air scribes. They're basically miniature jackhammers to chip all the rock away from the bone. And as we're removing the rock away, we are hardening the bone with a special type of plastic. It's a chemical that we apply. We dissolve it in acetone, and when the acetone evaporates, it leaves a thin layer of that plastic behind. And that strengthens and kind of glues the bones back together. And then sometimes if we have a fracture in a bone that we want to keep together, we use just regular old super glue to glue everything back together when we're going. If we have really heavy specimens, we'll use a 2-ton epoxy or something like that to glue the bones back together. But it's just usually just chipping away with our little tools. When we're getting to the fine detail, we'll use small needlework under the microscope to do the detail work around teeth to preserve the serrations. Or if they have ornamentation on the skull, like little pits and grooves, we'll keep that and together and use the little pin vices again to expose those little pits and grooves on the skull.
So how long does it take to completely chip away from all the stuff around the fossil? And will it be on display when you're all done? Does it get set up as a complete or a nearly complete T-Rex?
How long a specimen takes really depends on how hard the rock is and how big the specimen is. Our skull block that we have right now, I originally came in as 1,300 pounds. And that will probably take a year of chipping away to get all the rock away from that skull and the bones. And then as we're working on that, we remove 60 total blocks from this quarry. So we'll be working on other ones while we're working on that one. So when it's all said and done, the whole skeleton with a team of 30 people working on it will probably take us a year to 2 years to get the whole specimen prepared out to where it looks beautiful and ready for display. And then the next step is it goes up into collections to get all of its catalog and information covered. And then we'll make a replica of it. And usually it's the replica that we display here in the museum. As if you mount the original bones, it's really difficult to put them in lifelike positions. And also if fellow researchers want to study it, it's a little more difficult for them to get on ladders and measure the elements. So it'll probably take a year to then cast all the material that we have. So probably about 3 years from now is when you'll see it on display in the museum. But for right now, because it's in our prep lab and there's windows into our prep lab, you can look into the prep lab and see it being prepared probably over the next year, year and a half or so.
The collections are open this weekend for behind the scenes, but there are so many items that you have to keep track of. How do you find all of them? What's the cataloging process like? And I'm wondering if you can speak to the types of maintenance that these different items require. Which ones require the most maintenance and the most care?
So the ones that we put together that have the most maintenance and care are our holotype collections. And a holotype for a dinosaur is the one where you name the species based off that individual, and it serves as the record. If you were to find a second tyrannosaur, you compare it to this one in our collections that's a holotype. So those ones tend to get the most care, and typically for ours, it's we make an archival plaster jacket to support the bones, so the weight of the bones themselves do not cause them to break. Some of our older collections require some extra attention too, because they used glues back in the 50s and 60s that weren't as archival as our modern day glues. So sometimes they will break, and if they do break, we will modernize them with modern day glues and keep them together. And another practice back in the day was to use plaster or carbondo to fill in gaps, and that's not exactly the best thing to use anymore. So sometimes we remove that old filler that was put in and use more modern day fillers on there. So a lot of them, it's as, and we try to handle them as little as possible. So when the researchers come in, we have them, since they're in these large plaster jackets that are archival, they can flip over the bones without actually picking up the bones and flipping them, because that's usually when the most damage occurs, is when we're picking up bones to study them. A piece accidentally breaks off, or you're picking up two sides and the middle collapses out. And usually it then comes back down to my lab and a team re-glues them and gets them back together. Most of the time for caring for them, it's having space and making sure we distribute the weight of the specimens correctly so that they don't break under their own weight.
Is there any space left? What do you do with all of the items? I mean, the museum is only so big, and at some point, are you gonna run out of room? What do you do with the items then?
There is a possibility for us running out of room. I still think we got a little ways to go before we run out of room, but that opinion changes on the day and who you talk to in collections. But if our collections grow so large, then hopefully eventually we can do an addition onto the museum or something, or build our collection space. Or there is room in our collections to go up, so we can add cabinetry above and move some of our smaller specimens to there and move some of the larger ones around. So there's a little shifting that we can do. And then as long as we catalog everything in our database of where a bone moves into the collection, so each bone is labeled as a shelf. It's like it's in cabinet 3, shelf 2, back quadrant. So we can then track that bone. And then if we move it later for space, we just track that change and where it moved into the cabinet. So as long as we do things like that, there's always a little bit of room, and we can always find ways to try to cram more fossils in, because we're not going to stop looking for fossils.
And it seems like there is a huge supply of fossils still to be found. But right now, everything is on display for people to come see. But the museum's purpose isn't just to, you know, exhibit these items. Can you talk about any of the research that's happening with some of these fossils, or what kind of research is planned for the T-Rex?
So some of the research that we hope to do with our Tyrannosaur is we want to do histology on it. And histology is basically cutting open one of the limb bones and counting lines of arrested growth, similar to how you would count tree rings on a tree, to figure out how old the animal was when it died. Some of the other research that we're doing is there's a dinosaur in our collections called Parasaurolophus, and it's a dinosaur that I actually study. And some of the research I'm doing on that right now is, because we have so many skulls of that animal now in Utah, we have 17 compared to the rest of the world has 7, I'm studying how the skull changes from baby all the way to adulthood. So there's lots of research. We have, from Grand Staircase, we've named 20 dinosaurs in the last 15 years, and we have another 10 waiting to be named. So there's research going right now of naming all these new dinosaurs that we found. So in the next 2 to 3 years, we hope to have 10 more brand new dinosaurs named from our collections. And there's just always ongoing research, and histology is kind of relatively new compared to some other things. So now there's a focus of going back and cutting open limb bones and seeing how old these dinosaurs were when they died, and reconstruct of like how quickly these animals were growing and maturing to adulthood. And then you can tie that into lots of other further research from there. So we're doing lots of brand new research with all the specimens that we find. And every year we're guaranteed pretty much to find something brand new no one's ever seen before, or learn something brand new no one knew before.
I've never met a dinosaur before, so I asked Bertha Cell to introduce me to the Tyrannosaur. We started with the skull, which was still encased in plaster and concrete.
So what are we looking at here?
So we're looking at pretty much a complete articulated skull of a Tyrannosaur. So looking right here, this bone is the upper jaw, called the maxilla. And in the maxilla, we have two teeth actually still in their tooth sockets right here. And then if we trace that maxilla up to the next bone right here, we have a bone called the jugal, which is the cheekbone. And there's a little notch there. And that where that notch tells us is if we come straight up in the opening right above that cheekbone is where the eye socket should be. So the eye should be right about here. And if we were to continue preparing all this rock away, we'll see the lacrimal bar that connects to the top of the skull to really outline the orbit. And then we go to the back of the skull where we have the lower jaw actually still attached and articulated. So that's the back of the lower jaw. This is the back of the skull. And then right here we have the skull roof. And then if we go towards the front, we just started exposing a little bit towards the naris. So we have the nostrils starting to open up right here. And then this animal died with one of its legs draped over its skull. So this bone right here, that's right in the middle of an opening in the skull, is actually not a skull bone, it's one of its toe bones.
Ah!
And then we have another bone pressed up against the nose right here that we're not sure what it is. I'm actually trying to figure out what that bone is. And then this is the upper leg, the femur, that's pressed up right against
it. This is the leg?
Yep, this is one of the leg bones. So this is the femur, the upper leg. And then pressed up against there, where the rib cage was all on that side of the specimen, this is the shoulder blade and the coracoid, which is basically equivalent to like our collarbone. So, and then we have another bone that I don't know what that bone is yet. So we're still... It'll take us probably a year to get all the bones out of this specimen. And as we go, we'll learn what some of these bones are that I'm not entirely sure are right now.
Considering the position in which it died, does that tell anything about how it died?
A little bit. It probably, most of this animal was articulated, so it was in life position. The only parts that were not were this one leg and part of the pelvis. But the rest of it pretty much was. So it was kind of in the classic death curl position that suggests that this animal sat out on the surface a little bit and kind of dried out before it got buried. And the geology around us, around the bones, tell us that this was on a point bar in a stream system. So that's probably how it eventually got buried, as it got buried in this stream, and why I probably lost parts of the tail, as those were the lighter bones that got carried away by the currents in the stream. So we still, as far as why it died, we still really don't know. We haven't seen any puncture bone marks in the bones or anything saying anything ate it or tried to eat it. It could be, we're still not sure why it died, and we might be able to form a hypothesis if we expose more bones, but we're still not sure yet.
Do you know about when it died? Do you figure that out based on what kind of rocks you find it in?
Based on the geology of the area, and we don't radiocarbon date. We use a different isotope to do it. So we'll either use potassium argon or argon argon dating, because the half-lives are much longer. And we look for volcanic ashes, and the ashes around this specimen say it's about 75 million years old. Now, if I had to hazard a guess of how old this animal was when it died, I'd say it was probably between 8 to 10 years old when it died. And one of the ways we could tell it is, like I said, we could cut open one of those limbs and see how, count the lines of arrested growth and see how old it was when it died. This is probably an angsty teenager. It's not a full-grown adult, and one of the ways that we are assuming it's not a full-grown adult is not all the bones that fuse in adulthood are fused in this specimen.
What kind of bones?
So a few of the bones in the skull are not completely fused, but one of the big main ones that told us is the ankle bone, the astragalus, in Tyrannosaurus fuses to the tibia in adulthood, and we found these not fused together. Also, looking at some of the size, comparing it to what we do consider an adult specimen, and we have a subadult specimen, this is kind of in between those two. So the subadult's probably not quite a teenager yet, whereas this one's probably near the tail end of being a teenager.
So we have a more complete picture with this one now of like the different stages of the T-Rex's life. What will that tell you, you know, doing research on this? What does that tell us about the T-Rex?
It can give us an idea of how quickly it grew to adulthood and how fast it did that. There's another possibility if we cut open into the leg and find medullary bone. It's a special type of bone only females produce when they're about to lay eggs. So if we were to find that, we could tell that this is a female or not. And then we could look at differences between this skeleton and the other to see if we can see differences between possible males and females. That one's a little more difficult. You need a lot of specimens to be able to do that. But some of the other cool things is our other Tyrannosaur that we have, that's Teratophonius, that's what we think this guy is, that's at the same time, are only about 15% complete, and this one's 80% complete. So we get to flesh out a lot of bones that we kind of had to guess what those bones looked like. And so it really helps complete the picture of what this dinosaur actually looked like.
That was Tyler Berthesel, paleontology lab and field manager at the Natural History Museum of Utah. In late October, news broke that President Trump would approve Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke's recommendation and state leaders' request to adjust the boundaries of both Bears Ears and Grand Staircase Escalante National Monuments. And Trump is expected to announce the shrinking of the monuments during a visit to the state in early December. I talked with Brian Switek, author of the Laylapse blog with Scientific American, about what fossils are yet to be discovered in the Grand Staircase Escalante region and the relationship between conservation and the study of paleontology. All of my colleagues recommended you to me as the guy to talk to about dinosaurs. And looking through your blog and publications, I don't know if I've seen anyone more enthusiastic about dinosaurs since Dr. Alan Grant from Jurassic Park.
I appreciate that you said enthusiastic instead of obsessed. I much prefer that word.
Tomato, tomato, yeah. Whatever works for you. But you've written about T-Rexes before on your blog, so I'm wondering if you're interested in commenting on its distant cousin, the Tyrannosaur fossil that was recently excavated at Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument. This one is said to be 80% complete. I actually saw it at the Natural History Museum of Utah this past weekend. I'm wondering if it being 80% complete is unusual, and how interesting was this discovery to you?
Well, absolutely. This is a really fascinating discovery, partially because, I mean, Tyrannosaurs, they've got, you know, their PR really working for them for the past 100 years or so. These are the celebrities of the dinosaur
right.
world. And carnivores in general are rare, and to find an 80% complete carnivore is even rarer, much less one in articulation. So this isn't just a jumble of bones that we really have to stitch back together and say, okay, is that tail vertebrae supposed to be in position 6 or 7? Like, a lot of the skeleton is still in place. So it gives us a good view of what this animal was like in life. So we have a species that's found nowhere else in the world. It's only found in southern Utah. It's a relatively young individual from what I understand. So we can learn some new things about how these dinosaurs grew up. It's just rare because it's a carnivore. So it's really like one of these, like, you hope that you find this. This is like the once in a lifetime find.
So what does it mean to the paleontology community to have found this? I mean, never seen anything like this before. What kind of ideas were sparked from this discovery?
Well, I mean, that's what we're going to find out, right? So there's, you know, this sort of stuff takes years to sort out. The initial discovery was about 2 years ago by Alan Titus, the BLM paleontologist who found it. It just came out this past summer. The excavation process is going on now to see, you know, how all those bones fit together. Once that's done, there are all kinds of analyses that we can do on the skeleton, find out who its closest relatives were, find out the relative age of this animal. Was it a teenager? Was it an adult? You know, and learn a little bit more about the lifestyle of this animal from that. There are other geochemical analyses that can be done about, you know, what it was drinking or eating. So really, we're just at the very beginning of sort of parsing all this information that's held in that skeleton. Like every piece of bone, even just a little scrap of bone that you might see out in the Badlands, has stories to tell. It's just a matter of asking the right questions. So that's the exciting part right now, is like, what amazing things are we going to find out about this animal?
As someone who closely follows new discoveries in paleontology, I'm wondering if you can talk a bit about how conservation plays into the ability of paleontologists to find fossils like this. And I'm thinking especially of where this was found in Grand Staircase and, you know, the likelihood that the president will try to shrink the size of the national monument when he visits Utah next month. So how do you think that'll play into paleontological discoveries going forward?
Well, public lands are really critical. I mean, Utah is really a great state because our population center is in Salt Lake City. Most of the state is wide open. Much of it is federal land. And because of that, we have these amazing fossil resources out there, you know, just waiting to be discovered. I mean, one of the reasons I moved to this state from New Jersey is because we have the right rocks in the right time period with lots of fossils in them that are protected by our federal and public lands. And it's really been frustrating to see, you know, this concerted effort to shrink those or take that away from the public. I like calling them public lands because they belong to all of us, what we're learning from these places. And the beauty of these places belong to the American people. And I really hate to see those sold out, basically, to energy companies. And this isn't just something coming down from above from Secretary Zinke or the Trump administration. This has been a concerted effort from, you know, our local representatives, I'm sorry to say, people like Rob Bishop and Jason Chaffetz and Orrin Hatch, what people call the second sagebrush rebellion, to try and take away public lands or sell those lands out to energy development. And like I said, this isn't something that's new. This has been going on for decades, and it's frightening to see this, to think of what we might lose, the knowledge that we're going to use, even just the natural beauty of these places, that now you can drive out and you can see it for yourself. And it's wonderful. I'd hate to see fences go up around those things and limit our enjoyment and what we're able to learn from these places.
Talking a bit about how the processes behind energy exploration and extraction might affect these fossils. I mean, big trucks and the processes of extraction, digging through layers for coal. How would that affect fossils in the area?
It might destroy some of them. It might limit areas that we're able to go and explore for fossils that might be on private land. They're basically off limits to fossil exploration. And because of the laws that we have in the nation regarding fossil materials, if a fossil is found on private land, those companies would be under no obligation, if they found something significant, to turn that over to researchers or even alert researchers. We'd hope that they would, but there's no regulation for them having to do that. And there's also damage to the local environment that's done. Aside from just the physical effects of drilling or coal extraction, there are things like oil spills in Grand Staircase that, you know, happen that nobody knows about until some hiker stumbles upon it years and years later. So this could really limit our ability to search for fossils. There might be some, you know, really wonderful and informative fossils. This Grand Staircase in particular, and also Bear's Ears, which is also under threat, just completely rich with fossils. These are some of the best places in the world. And instead of being proud of that fact, I feel like that has been sort of buried in this entire debate.
And it seems like we've basically scratched the surface of discovering these fossils. In an interview with High Country News, Alan Titus, who discovered the Tyrannosaur, called the Kiperowitz one of the last untapped dinosaur graveyards in the world, which I think speaks to what is actually out there, or what they could potentially find. So if scientists don't have access to these fossils, how will that impact the research they're working on and what we can learn about dinosaurs, and also, you know, what we can learn about our environment and climates now from that research?
Yeah, I mean, we stand to lose a lot of information, a lot of context. I mean, this isn't just fossils for scientists. This is our natural history heritage. It's the history of the place that we live in. It's like nowhere else in the world. Utah, I mean, Grand Staircase itself is one of the last places in the continental U.S. to be mapped, to even see what is out there, much less be explored for fossils. During the great bone rushes of the late 19th century and the early 20th century, Utah was kind of passed over in favor of places like Wyoming and Colorado and Montana. We're really only just starting to see even what's out there. I mean, you find a dinosaur out there, there's a good chance it's going to be a new species that no one has seen before. We're really only just putting together what the fauna was like of this time. And I'm glad that you brought up climate change and other environmental effects as well, because the better picture that we can get of what animals were there, how they changed over through time, how they evolved or went extinct, with the fluctuations in climate in the past, the better we can get an idea of how our landscape is going to change going into the future now that we're modifying climate, speaking of fossil fuels. So this is really the context for where we live, and I really hate to see that limited or taken away from us. You know, this is something that was already established, you know, the Grand Staircase in the 1990s, you know, Bears Ears is relatively new. But these designations, they're not arbitrary. It's not taking something away from anybody. This, we're preserving them because these places are unique. They're special. They mean a great deal to the public and the people with connections to that land and what we can learn from them. And I think that really should be preserved.
Back to the dinosaurs, because yes. I know that's what
that's what I know best. Yeah.
What do you hope to see come out of this region dinosaur-wise next?
Well, to make a little bit of analogy, so this spot in Utah, particularly in Grand Staircase, the time period that we have preserved is about 75 million years old, more or less. And there are sites up until Montana and Alberta from about the same time period. And those are relatively well known. And we have a good picture of the dinosaur species that were living there, how they changed over through time, what their environments were like. And we're just starting to do that in Utah. So like I said previously, when you find something articulated or something relatively complete, or really just a dinosaur site in general, there's a good chance that either this is something new or it'll give us a better picture of something that really has just been discovered in the past 20 years or so. So we're really only just starting to fill out what dinosaurs were there. And this follows what's called a discovery curve. You usually find the big animals first because there's a lot more of them. They get preserved easier. But the smaller animals, like the velociraptor-sized animals or the bird-sized animals, we don't have those yet. We're still, you know, looking for them and trying to fill out that part of the fauna. And really, like this larger amount of biomass, it's harder to pick out. So there's a lot of potential there. And by filling that out and comparing this information to other places across North America from about the same time period, this is one of the really neat things about Grand Staircase is that you don't get the same dinosaurs like all up and down this ancient coastline. They're different in every single pocket, these little islands of evolution that tell us something special was going on about 75 million years ago. So really, you know, it's only been the past 30 years that people have even been looking, much less excavating, discovering, finding new things. So the potential to really change our view of prehistoric Utah is really fantastic.
That was Brian Switek, science writer and self-described fossil fanatic based in Utah. Have you seen the Tyrannosaur fossil? Let us know at KCPW's Facebook page, KCPW88.3, or feel free to email us at comments@kcpw.org with your feedback and questions. Thanks to the KCPW team for their support of this show, as well as to Andrew Shaw, who composed the show's theme music. And thank you for tuning in. You can find podcasts of this program on our website, kcpw.org. Up next is Both Sides of the Aisle. I'm Emily Means. Thanks for listening.